Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Millions of American children live in homes where parents abuse drugs or alcohol, where crime and jail time cling to mom and dad, where family violence is routine, and the way up and out is brutally hard to see. 14-year-old Asiya Johnson seemed to have found the way with grit and determination and a big smile in spite of the odds, and then she burned to death with her little sister in her arms. Mom on drugs, dad in jail, this hour on Point. Girl neglected. Asiya Johnson's story, her dreams, and the hurdles facing millions of American kids. You can join the conversation. What does it take to break free from the mean streets, from drugs and violence and abuse? Do you know what it takes to dream when your own family is pulling you down? Joining me now in the studio are Boston Globe reporters Keith O'Brien and Donovan Slack. Asiya Johnson's story unfolded here in Boston in our own backyard. O'Brien and Slack reported the story in terrible and riveting detail for the Boston Globe. Keith, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be here.
Donovan, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you, Tom.
It is a terrible and riveting story, and you've told it very compellingly. You've really put in the work to let Asiya Johnson almost speak from beyond the grave, and we're grateful for that. There's a moment that sort of captures this right at the top of your story, right really at the end of her story. Donovan, paint that picture for us of Asiya and her 3-year-old sister Sophia standing in their row house in South Boston as flames engulf their house. Take us to that moment. What happened?
That's right. The two sisters were trapped on the third floor of the house as the flames were approaching from behind. There was her mother and her brother safe on the ground, and other people down there were yelling at Asiya to throw her 3-year-old sister down to them and to jump herself. But Asiya couldn't bring herself to do it. She said, "I can't drop her." And then she retreated with her little sister into her bedroom closet where they died together.
Keith, how were they found? What's known about the last seconds of her life?
Well, as Donovan just described, that's the last time anyone saw them alive. Later that evening, after the fire had been snuffed out, firefighters crawled their way up the stairwell into the third floor, and using heat sensors, because the fire was in the middle of the night, using heat sensors, essentially night vision goggles, could see the heat of their bodies still left over in the closet, and they say they found them there entwined together.
Donovan, this was alleged arson. Allegedly, Asiya and Sophia's father was in jail at this time. Their father, Ray, their mom, as you say, made it out with her, with Asiya's twin brother. But the allegation here is arson. Her mother had taken a lover, not her father, a woman, and the allegation is that that woman, in a fit of anger, sprayed accelerant into the front of the house and lit it on fire.
Absolutely. The mother had taken up with this woman a couple of months before the fire, and the woman ended up moving into the house while the father was away in jail. And police alleged that this woman, in a rage, doused the front entryway to the house with a flammable liquid and set it ablaze.
Keith, Asiya Johnson seemed to have everything going against her, and yet she seemed to be pulling up out of this tough inner-city environment with a troubled family on many counts. Give us the background first. We'll hear about what she was accomplishing. I mean, she had a straight-A report card waiting for her. She had a ticket to a good high school in Boston beyond her neighborhood. She was emerging as a top athlete in her middle school, 14 years old. But in terms of her family environment and history, what was she up against?
Well, this home in South Boston was like many homes, not just in this city, but in cities and towns across America. You had a mother, as you said, who was on drugs, a father who was a petty criminal and a chronic drinker who spent more time in jail than out over the years. The parents, when they were together, fought, often violently, and the violence sometimes turned on the children themselves. This was a home that the State Department of Social Services here in Massachusetts visited on a number of occasions over the years, substantiating cases of neglect. In fact, to the point that in 2003, a court order ruled that the children, the twins, Asiya and her twin brother, Ray Jr., should go to live with their paternal grandmother. That court order came in effect in 2003, but our reporting shows that soon thereafter, the children returned to live with their mother and their father in the same house in South Boston where the problems continued.
Donovan, in spite of these problems, and we'll look at them in more detail because it's just, it breaks your heart to think of a 13 and 14-year-old struggling against these. Asiya was one of those kids who was making it. She was stepping up. She was stepping out. She was trying on her terms. Show us the light here, the light side of Asiya's life.
Absolutely. What was remarkable, I think, as we learned more about this young girl, was that no matter what was going on around her, she was almost in the parental role. She was constantly asking her mother to please stop doing drugs. She was asking her father, please get a job, please don't do any
more crime. Get a job, stay out of jail, don't stop shoplifting, stop stealing.
Absolutely. And neither parent listened, they admit now. But Asiya herself was excelling in school. She was becoming a star on her middle school basketball team. She had become the main caretaker for her little sister, Sophia, who was 3 years old. And it was remarkable. I kept thinking to myself as we were reporting this story, where did she get this? Where did she learn this? It's just remarkable that she rose up in the middle of all of that chaos.
Keith, the community knew it. After this death, when people turned out to remember Asiya, they knew they'd lost someone special, someone who had really pushed against tremendous odds here.
That's right. I mean, imagine this scene, if you will. Her father was arrested the last time that she was alive, last October. And at that point, things began to truly unravel in their house. Shortly before that final arrest, her parents fought violently in the house and spilled out into the street in South Boston, waking up the kids, waking up the neighbors. And there was Asiya in the doorway with her little sister telling her parents, her 34 and 37-year-old parents, if you don't stop, I'm going to take the baby and leave.
A 13-year-old saying that to her parents.
That's right.
Her taking on that responsibility or trying to or wishing to.
That's right. And another credible thing about her was, you know, when she was at school, it was as if she could wall off her problems at the doorway to that house in South Boston. She didn't talk about the violence in her home. She didn't talk about the visits from DSS social workers. She didn't talk about the drugs or the drinking. She was a good student. And I want to stress that she was one of those students who had to work for what she got.
It wasn't a breeze, but she did it.
She worked hard. She was determined. She would raise her hand if she didn't know the answer. She wanted to do well. She knew that academics was her way out. And as you hinted at a moment ago, she would later learn earlier this year in February as she took on basketball that athletics actually might be a way out.
Give us a sense of some of the illustrative moments in her family history of the kind of the rap sheet, the down and dirty moments that Asiya had to deal with as her parents struggled with drugs, with crime, with jail time. You know, give us a sense of just what that meant in her life.
By the time the children were born, her father had a rap sheet that was already very extensive. They left Boston, this is back in 1993-94, and moved to Florida to try to escape, try to get away. But as Donovan and I learned, as soon as they moved there, essentially to Florida, the problems continued. Anna was shoplifting. There was violence between the parents. And within months, both of them were charged there, he with battery, she with child abuse. She was charged with child abuse after she left the children, who were barely 1 year old at that point, the twins, home alone for 5 hours, according to our reporting and according to records, and went to attack her boyfriend, Ray, at the place where he worked, spraying him with pepper spray. They're both charged, and they're both supposed to follow certain probation requirements. But soon after that, they leave Florida where the warrants for their arrest are still outstanding.
A very volatile family, a volatile marriage. They're back in Massachusetts, and Asiya and her brother are in a stolen car with them when her parents are arrested for shoplifting. I mean, they witnessed the whole thing. They're with them.
Yes, Tom. As they got older, the children actually became part of these criminal activities. In 1999 in particular, they
were... Not willing participants,
no,
but just along
the
for the ride.
The parents were taking them along.
Mm-hmm.
For example, as you mentioned, in June 1999, the parents stole a minivan, loaded up the kids, and went to a Marshall's store where the parents were then charged with trying to steal $250 worth of clothes. Now, when they got to the police station, the police officers asked them to please call someone to collect the children. No one came. So the social workers actually had to be summoned to come and take the children away.
And that's just one. I mean, it was incident after incident. It was crime. It was beatings at home. It was drugs in the family, both of their parents. And finally, fire, arson, with her standing there with a 3-year-old little sister in her arms. It's an incredible story. It reminds us what it takes to get out of this kind of situation, what the obstacles can be, and in this case, a very tragic ending. Keith O'Brien and Donovan Slack have written the story up for the Boston Globe. We're looking at it, as Keith O'Brien says, you can imagine it in any city in America. This one happened in our backyard, and we're paying attention because it's a national dynamic, a national problem. Behind me, South Boston musicians Marcus and Point Blank, they wrote the song Hold On about the fire that killed Asiya and Sophia Johnson and about the loss for their mother, Anna Rysopoulos. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this time about the heartbreaking story of a 14-year-old inner-city girl who was beating the odds, making it on her own gumption, and now she's dead, burned to death in an alleged arson, holding her 3-year-old sister in her arms. Asiya Johnson died with her sister Sophia Johnson just about 8 weeks ago. Keith O'Brien and Donovan Slack, Boston Globe reporters, went back to recreate the childhood of this very young woman, the lives of her and her family, her struggle to get up and out, and the bitter end of that struggle as she died holding her sister, unwilling to throw her out the window. You can join the conversation. What are kids like this up against in our cities? And can you imagine what it takes for a child to break out? We'll hear in a few minutes from the principal of Asiya Johnson's middle school in South Boston and from the commissioner of the Department of Social Services in the state where the whole incident took place. Let's take a call from Julia in East Hampton, Massachusetts. Julia, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to make a comment, sort of a hopeful comment, even though this is an incredibly sad story, that people do rise above incredible adversity and thrive, and I am an example of that. And I just wanted to say that it's incredibly sad, and people deal with all kinds of horrible situations in their early life, and you can actually make change and live.
When you hear of the neglect that Asiya struggled through, can you relate to it personally, Julia?
Yes, I can.
Give us a sense.
A lot of neglect, abandonment, malnourished. I lived on the street for a while. I come from a historically wealthy family, but they just couldn't keep it together. And my brother decided to end his life a year ago, and my sister is barely alive, and I'm doing great. So people deal with this in all different ways, but you really can make change and move on.
You know, the parents in this story come out looking pretty bad, but of course their lives weren't exactly easy either. How do you think about your parents looking back on the neglect that you suffered, Julia?
I'm not sure what you're asking.
Well, do you blame your troubles on them? Do you see them themselves caught in a web of troubles?
I guess that's sort of the larger comment I'd like to make. They gave me a really rotten hand to play. But at a certain point in my life, I decided that it wasn't the only hand possible and that I could make my own. And I guess that's my larger point, that even though what I lived through was incredibly horrible, very different, but, you know,
Yep, but horrible enough.
And
with a terrible toll on siblings. But you made it out, and we admire that, Julia. And we hear your kind of gesture of affirmation for Sia Johnson. Unfortunately for her, fire and death came before she could. Let's get another call from Hampton Roads, Virginia, and Pamela. Pamela, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. This is a comment on the violent homes and the nightmare conditions that these kids live in, that it's not new. Not new by any means. I did not grow up in Hampton Roads, Virginia. I grew up in Central Ohio, and Central Ohio, the state of Ohio, had created a village for children who came from violent homes and who wanted to move up and move on. And in order to give them a stable home life and support system, they moved them into this village, and the village looked like little houses with a large house in the center. They lived in these little houses with adult monitors who helped them with everything, their health care, dental care, their homework, you know, the whole nine yards. And these kids went to school with us in the public school system. They got on the bus and came to school, and they, you know, took the bus and went home. Mm. And all of these kids who started school with us, and we knew they were from the village. You know, they, you know, literally said, oh, yeah, we live at the village. These kids who started school with us, they finished school with us, and many of them went on to college with us. It was a method of breaking this cycle.
So maybe a break for them in Central Ohio. It's a break Asiya Johnson didn't get, though there were efforts to get it for her. Pamela, thanks for your call. Let's get one from Salt Lake City, Utah. Larry, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, I think the way to solve the problem is really cut and dry, is that with the criminal record as long as what Althea's parents had, the solution to the problem is to yank their parental rights and put the kids up for adoption in a real household. That's how you solve the problem. And the DCFS needs to move in and quit coddling around saying all these people have parental rights when really they've abrogated their parental rights from the beginning.
Larry, let us pick up exactly that angle. Donovan Slack, that was tried. They were not supposed to be living in this house. At least Asiya wasn't.
Right, and it brings up a fascinating question that this story poses, which is how much can government do in these situations? How much should it do? What do we expect it to do? In this particular situation, they intervened and took the kids away.
Well, they took Asiya and her twin brother. But her parents had the little child, 3-year-old Sophia, deliberately had this baby at home on the bathroom floor, basically, to avoid its existence being known by the state.
That's right. They had they were so scared that DSS, the social workers, would take away their next child that they gave birth to her in the South Boston house on the bathroom floor.
Wow. Wow. So they went to that extent, but they also, the state failed to see when, in fact, these kids were living back. The older kids were living back in the house, not off with relatives as they were supposed to be, Keith.
Time and again, they came out to the house in South Boston to substantiate cases of neglect or abuse and asked, why are these children here? They're not supposed to be here. The mother, Anna Rosopoulos, would say they were just visiting. The kids would say they were just visiting. And year after year, their court-appointed guardian, their grandmother, would sign a form with the state saying, yes, these children are staying with me. But a simple cross-check with other state agencies would have shown that Anna, the mother, was telling other state agencies, these children are living with me. I want food stamps for these children. I want housing vouchers for these children. And as simple as going to the school and saying, where do you think these children live? Mm. These children, everybody knew, lived in South Boston.
Anna Rosopoulos, the mother, Greek-American at home, teaching the kids the Greek alphabet, but in many other ways not delivering on their needs. Father Ray Johnson Sr., often just in jail. And Asiya Johnson trying to make it in school and making great strides on that front. We have with us right now the principal of her middle school, the Patrick F. Gavin Middle School in South Boston, where she was a student until her death in that alleged arson 2 months ago. Principal Lex Matthews joins us. Principal Matthews, thanks very much for being here.
Oh, thank you.
How has the school taken Asiya Johnson's death?
It's been extremely hard. On the day of the incident, we did bring a number of faculty members into the school building, and we opened the school up. And brought all the children from the area, from, you know, 8 or 10 blocks away, to be able to come in and talk to somebody. We had grief counselors on hand, and of course we were here. But it was devastating. And obviously the following days at school, you know, the Monday, the Tuesday, the Wednesday, were all extremely difficult with for faculty and students. There was a lot of people were extremely upset.
Asiya, or Cece as she was known at school, was a straight-A student in that semester. She was emerging as a real star on the middle school basketball team. Did you have any idea, Principal Matthews, just how rough her home life was?
Not at all to that extent. A couple issues here and there, sort of allusions to situations not being perfect. But Tom, no, not to that extent at all.
And when you read the very detailed story that Keith O'Brien and Donovan Slack put together, I mean, what was your response when you got to see the lid lifted here on what she'd been grappling with on the other side of her good performance at school?
Well, and again, that had come out in previous media reports before. I think the difference in the GLOW piece was that it was just so comprehensive and really described how difficult it really had been from the beginning, not just in the last 2 to 3 years. I was completely struck by how difficult it had been for her, and she never, ever used her situation at home as an excuse. She never brought it up. In fact, she deliberately didn't bring it up, instead trying to focus on just what she was doing in school and trying to just control her fate here in the school building. And that is a situation that a number of city kids encounter, which is that the school is the one place that can be a safe haven for them and can be an atmosphere in which they are in charge. And that was definitely the case with Asiya.
Principal Matthews, can you put into words what it takes for a child in her circumstances, you know, to hold it together at school? She's half holding her family together, and she's doing it at school. I mean, what does that take of in this case, an inner-city child up against those odds, those headwinds?
I think what's critical for a child like that is incredibly dedicated teachers. Without that, school isn't the safe haven anymore. And it doesn't represent an area that she can control. Some schools don't have the faculty we have, and I think that was really essential for her to be able to feel successful.
Let's get a call from Boston. Jeannie is on the line. Hi, Jeannie. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I wanted to say that I've been really, really struck by this story. I am originally from South Boston.
Mm-hmm.
By the time I was 19, I had 3 children of my own, drug and alcohol issues, bad relationship issues, a lot like this woman. The difference was that I was fortunate enough to be supported. There's a program in South Boston called Julie's Family Learning Program. And the model is a comprehensive model. When you have someone like Anna or someone like myself who is obviously very ill-equipped for the job of being a parent,
mm-hmm.
emotionally, spiritually, she obviously couldn't pull it together on her own resources. She obviously wanted the same things that we all want, for her family to be together, you know.
But Jeannie, let me ask you then, you were a teenage mother yourself in South Boston, as you say, drug and alcohol issues, bad relationship. Does that leave you sympathetic to Anna Rysopoulos here, who allowed her children, she allowed her children to end up in such terrible circumstances? Do you
Absolutely.
Want to criticize her or hold her hand? What's your thought on her?
I feel a sense of tremendous grief. I say, there but for the grace of God go I. You know, the difference between her and I is the network of support that I got. You know, anybody who knew me today would have no idea where I came from. You know, I work at a local institution of higher ed.
Yep.
I have a beautiful home in the suburb. I have a normal life, but it's because people taught me how to pay my bills, how to get counseling, how to live without drinking and drugging, how to have good relationships. I needed so much support to be able to do what most people take for granted. And I'm struck by this one-off approach that it, apparently her family was, you know, they dealt with, DSS was involved on one-off basis, but where was the network of support that allowed this woman, these children to put together a new life?
Not enough to make the step that you made, Asiya, now dead, and her mom having to deal with that. Jeannie, thanks for your call. Let me get one more here from Aiken, South Carolina. Reverend Ivara is on the line. Reverend Ivara, thanks for calling.
Yeah, hello, Tom. Thank you for receiving my call. I've been listening, and as I listened to the story, it really struck home. I was raised in Chicago and L.A., started doing marijuana at the age of 7 years old. Stepfather was an alcoholic. He used to beat us, and we were just terrified just being at home, so we took to the streets, and we were also, you know, in a situation where there were fires in the house, and you know, I really thank God that there was a way out for us, but I don't know if we don't pull together as a community with the schools, you know, working together with the parents, with DSS, I don't think we can just put a blame on just one, you know, one person in particular, but I think that we really need to come together and stop worrying about all these other things that are bothering us, you know, as a person, and just start looking out for one another.
Clearly, that would have been helpful here. Reverend Navarre, thanks very much for calling. Lex Matthews, you were the principal. Do you end up feeling, Asiya Johnson is dead. So is her little sister, Sophia. Our caller says it's not enough just to put it on the parents or just to put it even on DSS. The whole community has to come together as a school principal. Do you feel that you did all you could? You've got a lot of kids in that school. Was everything done that could be done by the community as far as you can see?
I think that all public schools, Tom, and really all schools are struggling with that very notion. Our role has become much more than what it used to be. And in regard to students like Asiya, we do see our responsibility not ending at the exit door. And it's obviously a question of resources when you have strong after-school components. The Gavin has programs like Citizen Schools that work with students every day after school for 4 hours a day. Programs like that are tremendously important. And so it really is an issue of resources in terms of giving Asiya a world that's apart from the dysfunction that she faces at home.
She wanted it. She tried to get it. And she ended up dead. Lex Matthews is principal at the Gavin Middle School in South Boston. Principal Matthews, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Donovan Slack, do you have a sense? I mean, you came to know her after she was already dead, Asiya Johnson. But do you have a sense of the girl in the window in those last minutes, her determination?
I really do, Tom. I can't even tell you how many sleepless nights I think myself and I know Keith had just reporting this story. She really came to life for us. As we talked with all of these people who knew her, including her mother and her father.
There's no more tears and there's no more cries. We're just sitting around all wondering why. Your life, don't you ever take it for granted.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the heartbreaking story of a 14-year-old inner-city girl who was beating the odds, making it on her own gumption, and now she's dead, burned to death in an alleged arson, holding her 3-year-old sister in her arms. Asiya Johnson, holding her 3-year-old sister, Sophia. They're gone. Their story written up in the aftermath of that fire by Keith O'Brien and Donovan Slack, reporters for the Boston Globe, who really put in the shoe leather to learn what had gone on in their but very difficult lives. It's an incredibly moving story. And I should say, you can find links to the story in a photo gallery and video all at our website, onpointradio.org. In just a moment, we'll hear from the state's commissioner for social services. First, let's go to Jennifer in Boston. Jennifer, you're on the air.
Hi, my name is Jennifer, and my young family and I live next door to the family. And Donovan, we just wanted to congratulate you on such a beautifully written article. It was a amazing tribute, and it really told all of the things for the last 4 years that we've witnessed, but we're a little too intimidated to do much about, understandably. We have at the time of the fire, we had a four-week-old newborn baby girl and a little boy that's not even two. And, you know, the whole situation's just been a nightmare for us and for another family who also lost their home. And
Jennifer, may I ask you, when you say you live next door, do you mean right next door?
We're two doors down, and the house in between, we've lost our home, and they lost their home as well.
You lost your home in the same fire?
Yes, in the same fire. There were three homes condemned and lost. One was the family that Donovan wrote about, and then our home and another neighbor's home. So there's three families that have had devastating consequences because of the fire. And
did you have a sense of what was going on in Asiya's home, in her house, in her family, Jennifer, three doors down?
Yes. We absolutely saw and witnessed so much of it, most of it in the middle of the night.
Like what?
Just screaming and yelling in the middle of the night, all night long. In fact, the night of the fire, when I heard the screaming and yelling at 3 a.m., I rolled over and said to my husband, "Here we go again. It's Saturday night." I mean, we weren't very alarmed by it.
There was a time when Ray Jr., Asiya's twin, was chased by his mom with a hammer. Did you see that?
Yeah, that was about 2 weeks before the fire when I had just come home with our new baby girl. She was maybe a week or two old. So that was sort of the most recent event. There were just escalating events that have gone on in the last few months, and it seems like the whole situation was just spinning out of control. And I don't know. The authorities just weren't there to do their job, and they weren't being held accountable. And this is sort of the culminating end result of all of the lack of accountability.
Yeah, and your family has paid a price with the loss of your home for what went on. In this family, people talk about the community in a way. You are the community, Jennifer. You're part of it. I mean, as you look back on it, was there more that you could have done, that the community could have done? Or, you know, do people have to wait for the government to show up? How do you think back on it now?
Thinking back on it, it's a difficult situation when you have two tiny children of your own. Sometimes you're too scared and intimidated to get involved because of the potential consequences. You're afraid your car might get keyed, or I don't know.
Donovan, it sounds like you know Jennifer. You know the neighborhood.
I absolutely do. Jennifer, thank you so much for your compliment on the story. And, you know, I know Jennifer went through incredibly hard times because of this fire, but also living next door to this family for as long as they did. And I know, Jennifer, you raise a really interesting question that I heard from a lot of people that were around this family, which is they said to themselves, well, what can we do? We should really do something here. But at some point, after so many calls to police and so many calls to social workers, I think certainly you talked with me about it, you say to yourself, well, they're not going to do anything. I'm just going to give up and live my own life.
And on it goes. Jennifer, how do you remember Asiya and Sophia?
Well, I always saw them as innocent victims. I always pitied all three of the children so much. I used to be a fourth grade teacher in Boston Public Schools, and, you know, my heart went out to them because I taught students like them every day. And what surprised me most about Asiya was always had a smile on, always had something pleasant to say, the nicest of manners, and I don't know, she just had a really charming and witty way about her, and we always pitied the kids because we knew how difficult their life was. Yeah. I didn't know it was quite this difficult. The article actually taught us a lot about we didn't realize it was quite this bad. We knew it was bad, but some of the horrific things that went on over there, we just did not know of.
A girl bucking the odds with a smile on her face, and you next door taking part of the losses and the loss of your house when the fire finally came. Jennifer, we're sorry for that loss, but we appreciate your calling. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
I want to turn now to the commissioner of the Department of Social Services in Massachusetts. This is a story that could have played out in any city and really community in the country, but this one happened in South Boston. Angelo McLean He's the commissioner in charge of the government institution that's supposed to take care of kids like this. Commissioner McLean, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom.
You are not a stranger to tough times as a kid. You spent 5 years on a ranch in West Texas for troubled adolescents. You, like ASEA, sports were kind of your ticket. You played tight end at West Texas A&M. You got your doctorate at Boston College in social work. But when you look at her struggle, her story as a human being, having been through tough times as a kid yourself, how do you feel about the position she was in those last, you know, years and weeks and minutes, Commissioner?
Well, you know, it's a situation where it was a family that needed a lot of help, and they had a sort of a close-knit family in terms of the paternal grandmother, the paternal great-aunt who was helping take care of the children. And, you know, and the article sort of points this out, despite the a lot of help that was available, it wasn't enough. And for a lot of children who are in similar situations, the help that's available is enough. And in this situation, it wasn't enough.
What can be done? They weren't supposed to be living at home, but they were. What can be done to try and prevent that from happening again?
In terms of a guardianship arrangement, when you have, say, a grandmother raising grandchildren and they're given guardianship, you know, part of the expectation is that the children will be having, you know, frequent contact with the biological parents. So we weren't necessarily surprised that was occurring. We were disappointed that the grandmother over time allowed the kids to sort of move in with the mother without, you know, sort of exercising the kind of judgment we had anticipated she was going to make. A number of things we're looking at is to see, you know, can we be, provide more sort of stipulations at the time of the guardianship? Can we strengthen we actually have a training that guardians go through as part of the guardianship process. Similar to training that foster parents go through, are there things we can do to strengthen that training? And we have sort of post-guardianship services. In this question, we have, are those services enough? Should we add more services?
The grandmother and the aunt, I think, were asserting that, in fact, the kids were living with them when they were not. Are they legally responsible for what happened here, or are you contemplating changes that would make people in that position legally responsible?
We're contemplating changes to make it real clear to folks that there's certain parameters. Because, you know, technically speaking, a guardian has the right to determine where the child's going to live and has the right to exercise decisions over, you know, visitation and, you know, similar as a parent. But when the guardianship is established as a result of child abuse and neglect, we ought not treat that as a typical guardianship, and we should look to see what other sort of stipulations could we put in place to make sure there are some parameters to give the guardian some, you know, clear guidance as here's what we're expecting.
Commissioner, let's get another perspective from the neighborhood. We've got Lori on the line from South Boston. Lori, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a social worker in South Boston, and I work with teens in the area, and I guess what I want to say is just that as people were doing in the sea of life, like the school, her basketball coach, her friends, like plugging into the kids, because they will respond to that.
Mm-hmm.
But related to DSS, I'm wondering, like, what kind of improvements can be made to the system? Because, like, I applied to be a foster parent, and because I can't afford a two-bedroom apartment on my salary, so because I have a huge one-bedroom apartment in the area, but I can't take in kids in that way because of that logistic.
Right.
So how can community members work better with DSS, even they can file anonymously. I don't know if people realize that.
You mean file some kind of complaint or warning to the authorities about what's going on?
It's a child abuse hotline. You can file anonymously as a neighbor, as a friend.
Yeah, that's correct.
Commissioner McLean, how do you see the community's role here? We've heard from neighbors, and Lori's in the neighborhood. I mean, How much can the community itself do? How much do you hope they'll do to help kids when they're in this tough a spot?
Well, one thing that's real clear is it takes a teamwork approach. You know, it takes social agencies like DSS, folks in the community, the school. And one of the things that we want to do a better job with is really having more of a positive image within the community, so folks will have an expectation that when they call us that we're going to follow through and do what we say we're going to do. And that we want to engage families in a positive way so they don't think that we're always, you know, the authority that's going to, you know, run over them, but basically we're there to help. And our job really is to help the parents, help the family do a better job raising their kids.
It's hard to do when there's so much trouble. Let me get one more call from Ginger in Columbia, South Carolina. Ginger, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
My question is this. Acia was a twin.
Yes.
We've heard a lot about her, about what she has managed to do, mm-hmm. which is truly incredible. But what has been happening to her twin brother?
Ray Jr.
Who survived the fire, who's, I'm assuming, going to the same school, under the same circumstances. What is he doing now? What is his life like?
Ginger, it's a good question. Keith O'Brien, what about her twin brother, Ray?
Well, as you say, Ray Jr. is still alive, and he is a child, so... you know, we won't go into the gory details, but essentially Ray Jr. is back living with his grandmother as the court order stated he should have been. And he, in fact, was not at school with Acia. He was expelled from school there at the Gavin in South Boston last year and is attending another school now. So
can't be easy.
He is obviously living with, you know, in the shadow of this tragedy.
Ray Jr., if you hear us, we wish you the very best of luck. And Angela McLean, what are your plans for this family going forward?
Our plans is to stay, you know, very connected with them, to support them through this, and to offer them as much services as possible, and try to be there to help make decisions. It's going to be tough for them because it's very tragic for them, and there's going to be a number of events, you know, holidays, birthdays, the anniversary of this event that are going to be very tough to get through. So we want to be there to help them get through those times.
Commissioner McLean, thanks for joining us.
All right. You're welcome.
Let me get a last call from Pittsburgh. Jared, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I guess I'm a child therapist, and I actually have worked with many families and children in situations similar to this. I wish I would have had a chance to ask the commissioner if the mission statement of a DSS or a CYF is to strengthen families or protect children. And I think until that question is answered, much of this will not change.
I mean, because you feel a tension there. If the kids are too vulnerable, just do you try to just get them out, or do you try and strengthen the whole family unit with them in it?
And I think that's the statement that, you know, that has to be addressed before we can make significant changes. There will be times when, many times when strengthening the families will not be consistent with protecting the child.
Jared, we hear the concern. Keith O'Brien, in those last minutes, Sia was not willing to let go of her little sister. In her tiny piece of this nuclear family, she was determined to protect, but it meant ultimately that they both died. Was there no way out of this house? Could she not have raced down those same stairs her mom and brother did?
At the time, so she was on the third floor. Mm-hmm. The night of the fire, the mother slept on the second floor, and Ray Jr. slept on the first floor. So she was at the top of the house. We don't know when Acia learned that the fire was burning. We don't know exactly, you know, what she saw in that stairwell. But we can tell you that firefighters themselves could not get up that stairwell. And they responded to that house within 3 minutes of the 911 call.
Wow.
So within 3 minutes of the call that there was a fire, firefighters in full gear, trained to enter burning home, could not walk up even to the second floor of that home. So I can't tell you, you know, what she saw, but I can tell you that there at the time that she stood in that window, there was no way out but that window.
And in those minutes, dreams died, a girl died, Acia Johnson and her sister Sophia. Keith O'Brien and Donovan Slack with the Boston Globe, we thank you for honoring this girl and her sister by going back and telling her story in such thorough detail. It's very illuminating for this city, for any city. Thanks very much for your work and for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can also see the story and a photo gallery as same location. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. There's no more crying, there's no more crying.